Hi, I'm Tom Evans and welcome to The Zone Show on Natural Health Radio. Today, I'm exploring with four different authors of different ages, different occupations, about how they enter the creative zone to write and publish their book. My first guest today is Ben Galley. Welcome, Ben.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Very good. Well, listen, I'm absolutely thrilled at your output. I've actually at last found someone that seems to generate as many books as I seem to every year. But you've got less years under your belt than me. How have you managed to produce so much in so little time?
Well, I think it's down to my sort of brain chemistry and my personality. I'm a very driven person. I always have been. Almost to sort of an OCD obsessive level, where if I'm not doing something to forward my career or doing something creative, I get very frustrated and sort of I lose my way. So my drive comes from that, and all I had to do was just apply it to my book. So it is part luck, but also it's something I've always wanted to do. So I have the obsession or the sort of just dream, if you will. And those two combine. Being an author is a dream that many people have had since a kid. And it's true of myself. I've always wanted to be an author. So for me, it's just wanting to achieve that dream gives me the drive to do it. And then combine that with my obsessive compulsive nature, I managed to get things done rather quickly.
But it's a kind of nice obsession, isn't it? It's an obsessive compulsive nature that's producing something. So how many books have you got in the Emanesca series now?
There are four. It is a trilogy of four parts.
I like that.
Yeah. The third book was split into two just because of its sheer size, and it couldn't make two separate books. I've also done a book in partnership with the Alliance of Independent Authors, and that was a non-fiction book, and it's a guide to self-publishing providers. And that's another hat that I wear as a self-publishing consultant and advisor. So 4/5 books.
and at the tender age of what? Do you mind sharing that with us?
Only 25, me.
Wow, that's amazing. So when did you start?
I've always been writing. I've been writing since I was, since I was old enough to be trusted with a pencil, which is pretty much true. I actually wrote a comic book when I was about 6. It was terrible, by the way. and then I wrote my first 2 full-length novels at around 11 and 12. And they will forever stay hidden away on my laptop, never to be seen by the world. But that's when I started. So I've been writing ever since I was a kid. But the Emanesca series and the first novel in that series, The Written, was my first debut novel as a serious professional self-published author.
And dare I say, it's very reminiscent of Tolkien.
Is indeed. Yeah, huge influence in my writing and in my general sort of in my life, really. I think it is a classic, and he is heralded as the father of fantasy. And whether you agree with that or not, I think he's single-handedly defined a genre that a lot of authors have followed in the footsteps of, myself included. And yes, I mean, there are a lot of references to Tolkien, obviously subtle references and subtext, but a lot of references to him and his works, not just Lord of the Rings, but The Hobbit and The Silmarillion as well.
And how do you avoid not copying him? How do you make it fresh, and how do you make it Ben's stuff?
Well, I like to blend a lot of other genres into my writing. So for me, the Emanesca series had a very clear tagline, which actually defined what I wanted to do with the series. And it was one of the first things I wrote down when actually planning the series out back in 2008 and 2009. And that was very, very simple and very Tolkien-led. And it was simply Lord of the Rings meets Sin City. So I wanted to take the fantastic vastness of Middle-earth, but bring it into sort of a 21st century market where, you know, we are interested in darker material, faster-paced material. I wanted to put a bit of mystery, a bit of crime in there, a bit more action-adventure, make it more of a thrilling ride. Not that I don't think Lord of the Rings isn't a thrilling ride, but markets... Yeah, the market has changed, we've moved on, and our tastes are different now. So I kind of wanted to do my own take of that sort of vast European, sort of Nordic world.
Wonderful. It sounds like it's got film written all over it.
Well, yeah, hopefully so. Fingers crossed.
Fantastic. So obviously you produce these books now, and also you've got this other hat as a non-fiction author. I'm sure any other authors listening to or watching this interview might ask, okay, so you've written the book, what now? How do you get books out there nowadays? How do you share them with your readership?
Well, I think you need to be ubiquitous in the market. And the good thing about the market now is it's largely digital. So the good thing is I can sit on my laptop and speak to people in China, in Brazil, South Africa, Australia, America, wherever. So I can engage with my readers a lot easier than the very early days of self-publishing, when it was a very physical world where you'd have to go out and talk to bookshops and do signings and do events and literally travel the country or the world. So that's the great thing about this day and age. So the marketing that I do is, like I said, very digital. It's all based on social media, on websites, mailing lists, emails, digital blogs, review sites, etc. So I maximize what technology has given me and try and just access every single avenue that I can. So my general marketing to-do list on a day-to-day basis will be the usual things like post on Twitter, post on Facebook, share some news about the self-publishing world or the book industry, but also then engage with people directly. So I will possibly try and source reviews from review sites. I will look at new ebook discovery platforms that are coming out and engage with them. And basically just trying to get on every single platform I can, because the thing is, readers are as widespread as the authors are these days. So there are many different ways, almost countless ways that a reader can actually find a book. So I try and reverse engineer that and think, if I were a reader, how would I find a book? So I kind of go about it, use Google to find out ways of finding new books, and then get onto those sites that I find, so then I can reach the reader. Another way is also using just general availability marketing, which is a more organic approach, which means you're just on every platform. So if a reader wants to read you on a Kindle, great, they can find me on Amazon. If they want to read me on some sort of obscure reading device, I want to make sure that I'm on that device as well. So I basically am accessible to every market and to every style of reader.
Got you. And this might sound like really complicated to an author that might be starting out, but there are some great support sites out there. You mentioned the Alliance of Independent Authors, for example.
Absolutely.
And I'm a member of that alliance too, and I just find that any question you don't know, you ask, and within 5 minutes, someone's come back with not one answer, but several answers that can really steer you on, which is just great. And how do you get on with sites like Goodreads and that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Goodreads is a great site, and I think social media has been an invention on its own when we talk about digital marketing. And for me, it's a great place to just really just chat to people and to find out what they really like about your books. And it's kind of stands apart from Twitter and Facebook because it is so book-centric and reading-centric. You find that people are there for one reason only. And pretty much that's the same reason for everyone. So it's great to find such a huge community of like-minded people. And for an author who's looking to market themselves or at least build relationships with readers, it's pretty much the number one site to go to. Okay. Twitter's great as well, and Facebook, but again, lots of different people. It's a lot wider. It's less niche. So that's why I think Goodreads is great, and it's one of the top three that I always recommend to the authors I help.
I noticed that you produced a graphic novel recently, or a graphic novel version of one of your books. And I've got to admit, I don't even know what a graphic novel is. What's a graphic novel?
Yeah, a graphic novel is basically an extended comic. So rather than have a comic that's released periodically, a graphic novel is usually a standalone piece of work, like a novel. They're increasing in popularity at the moment, thanks to technology. People can access them from all over the world. There are a lot of content creators jumping on the graphic novel bandwagon, thanks to the fact they're also now available on Kindle and a lot of other e-readers as well. So for me, graphic novel was a natural progression, hopefully on the way to film, who knows, but I wanted to really put some art to the words of Emanuska. As you said, there's something very sort of filmy and something very visual with my style of writing and with fantasy in general, and I wanted to capture that and put it into art and to colors and paint. So I'm producing at the moment, hopefully going to be out by Christmas, and it will be the graphic novel version of the first one, and then I'll hopefully release one every year until the series is finished.
And you used crowdfunding, didn't you?
I did indeed.
How does that work? And is it people just giving you money as a charity, or is there some other kind of mechanism going on there?
Yeah, some people do view it as a charity, and it has been referred to that in the past, but I kind of disagree. It's more just sort of a way to really engage with someone if you agree with their concept. And it's also a chance for a creator to offer engagement out to a wide audience. So instead of just taking the content once it's been released, you actually have a chance to participate in the creation process and help a creator actually produce something. So it's not just giving your money away for free. You do get something in return. And the fact that, I use Kickstarter. So what I would I did is offer rewards such as free copies of the books, or you know, a conversation with myself and the designer was one of the top prizes. And one of the actual most popular prize that I offered was the chance to actually be in the novel. It's really, really popular, and it's something that I've seen one person do before on Kickstarter. So I can't claim it's an original idea, but it's definitely an idea that I liked and did work. And I think that's really helped me to get to reach my target. And so people, backers are now sending in pictures to myself and the artist, and we're putting them into the novel and actually into the art on the pages, which is amazing. So you definitely do get a lot in return. So it's not just, you know, throwing your money away. It's a chance to engage, to be a part of a process, and to just generally help content creators get their work out there. So I think it's a really, really, really good platform and a really, really good concept. And I definitely recommend it.
Fantastic. So what's next for Ben Galley?
Lots of things. Well, that's a big question. I've recently launched my very own ebook store, which is called Libro, and it's an ebook store solely for indie authors. So if you're self-published, it's definitely the place to go and to upload your books. So that's taking up a lot of my time at the moment in publicizing and marketing that and pushing that forward. I'm also releasing a shelf help book to go along with my website, which is designed to help authors find their way through the market, and it gives advice and services for self-publishers. So I'm releasing a book of all my knowledge and experiences and putting that into paper form and ebook form. So hopefully that'll be coming out around Christmas as well, actually along with a graphic novel. And yeah, just general, you know, carry on the marketing, carry on the writing. Got a new book coming next year as well. So yeah, lots to do.
Great. And where can people find you, Ben?
You can find me on Twitter at Ben Galley or www.bengalley.com.
And that's G-A-L-L-E-Y.
That's it. Absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, great talking to you. And it sounds like we're going to have another conversation in about 3 or 4 months' time.
Hopefully so. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Ben. Some fantastic insights there from Ben. And my next guest is proof that we're never too old to write a book. So a big Zone Show welcome to James Sinclair. Hi, James.
Hi, Tom.
Well, I'm thrilled, James, that you've just published your first book at at 73 years young. Well done.
Thank you very much. It's always been my ambition to have a book published, but like everything else, everything gets put on the back burner, or when you're working, you're too tied down with other things. So retirement gave me the opportunity to write.
And it's called Over Our Heads.
That's right.
That's a very evocative title. So what's Over Our Heads all about, James?
Well, it's mainly the canopy of the sky, but also the subject matter, which can be over one's head. You watch these very complex documentaries on TV, and they go into explanations of black holes and wormholes and the warping of space and the Big Bang. And it can be quite mind-boggling. So the subject matter, to some, I suppose, is quite over their heads.
Because you, as well as explaining some fairly deep and big cosmological theories, you also go into the very small as well, don't you?
Yes. Those things are things that we don't see, but which are, you know, the essential building blocks of all life, you know, going from the atom to the molecule and the molecule to the cell. So these are things that we don't see and are invisible to us. And we need to think about them.
So is it fair to say then for us as humans to understand the very big, we've also got to understand the very small, and to understand the very small, we've got to understand and comprehend the very big?
That's true, because unless we understand the very small, we won't be able to comprehend the very big.
Got you. Now, James, you're not a professor in cosmology or astronomy or quantum physics. So what's a 73-year-old man like you writing a book like this for?
Well, I've always been interested in science. Ever since a child, I was always interested in science fiction movies, and watched documentaries on science programs, Patrick Moore, Sky at Night, and so I've always been interested in science and the universe and the stars and planets and everything else. So, you know, it goes back to very early in life, I suppose, because I was born in a town where the nights were so clear you felt that you could almost reach up and touch the stars.
And where was this that you were born to?
This was in Darjeeling in the Himalayas, where the sky, you know, where you're at an altitude of about 8,000 feet above sea level. And on clear nights, there's less atmosphere to look through, so things appear brighter and clearer.
So obviously you're based in the UK now and quite near London, and like me then, you suffer from not only the pollution in the southeast of England and Europe in general, but also streetlights.
The streetlights are a nuisance, yes. Fortunately, my backyard is a bit screened off from the streetlights, but there's still a few. And it's very, very distracting to find, lights hitting you all the time when you're out. They could do something about it, like putting shades down, but they seem to have them glaring everywhere.
What sort of readers did you have in mind, James, when you wrote the book?
Well, the type of reader I have in mind are those who don't know much about the universe or the stars, but would like to know a bit more, and get confused with these science programs, but would like to understand a bit better. So it's really aimed at the average person who doesn't look up very much at the sky, but who sometimes maybe wonders about it.
So from an age range perspective, this could be someone, a school child, or it could be somebody who's retired, I guess, and all points in between.
Yes, I suppose so, yes.
So, James, do you still have a passion for learning?
Yes, always. I always like to learn new things if I can, you know, try to get my head around computers and things like that. So I always have been interested in learning something new.
Well, I'm amazed at you, because not only are we having this conversation over Skype and doing this interview over Skype, but you've also set up a new blog, haven't you? www.overourheads.co.uk.
Yeah.
And you're getting at 73, you're getting your head around blogging, which I think is just amazing.
Well, they say you're never too old to learn.
And you're remarkably, you've got a Facebook account and a Twitter account. How much do you think this, you know, in these days where you hear lots of stories about people with old age dementia, how important do you think it is that we keep our grey matter ticking for our longevity and our good health?
Oh, well, I think it's very important that you keep your mind active. Dementia seems to be an ever-increasing thing now in old age. You must keep your brain active and alert. Probably people, you know, who don't think very much, or perhaps they have a lazy mind, you know. And I think then, of course, old age creeps in and dementia creeps in. And I think it's far worse to be mentally incapacitated than perhaps physically incapacitated.
Absolutely. So, James, you've now written book one. Is there a book two in the offing?
I think so, yes. There are thoughts whirling around in my brain about writing another book.
Oh, that's brilliant. I love to hear that. And I think what's interesting, because I think on my ninth book now, every time I write a book, I don't really know what's coming next, but one always seems to turn up at some point. And so it's a very pleasurable thing to do. Well, I've got to say, James, having read your book, I found it very clear, very easy to read. Even for someone like me that's studied astronomy in a bit more detail, there's still some real gems in there I didn't know about. And it's a great read for anybody that wants to understand
what's above our heads, what's obscured by the street lighting, what we can't see in our modern day cities. But it's all still there, and your book explains it really, really well. So well done, James, and I can't wait to see and read the sequel.
Thank you very much, Tom, and thanks for all your help, because and you are also very well up in matters astronomical, which was a great help.
You know, we couldn't have come together at a better time and a better place, James.
And also philosophical.
Yes, indeed. It's been a joy and a pleasure to work with you.
Thank you very much, Tom.
So onwards and upwards.
Yes.
Take care.
And you.
And we'll have you back on the show when the next book's out.
Okay. Thank you, Tom.
Pleasure.
So I hope that's inspired some of you to put pen to paper and start writing that book. It's never too late, as James proves. And my next guest is somebody, again, who's quite young, but I think who's written a book which goes way beyond his years. I'm Tom Evans, and a big Zone Show welcome to Ian Broom, author and the host of the Write for Your Life podcast. Hi, Ian.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Great to actually reciprocate, because I was on that said podcast, must be a year or two back now.
Indeed.
Yeah, so I've just read A for Angelica, and I was really, really drawn into the world you created. It seemed so real and actually so somewhat dark and comedic and even farcical. But I'm kind of puzzled, though, that the themes you explore which seem to require real-world knowledge I would only expect from someone twice your age. Where does that depth of experience come from?
Well, that's true. And one of the questions that I've been asked most, actually, when I've been promoting the book is, why did you decide to? So I'm 32. I started writing the book when I was, 23, 24.
Wow. And... Well, see, that makes it even more remarkable.
I know. And so everyone says, why did you choose to write the book as a 50-year-old or a 52-year-old or whatever Gordon Kingdom is, the narrator? And there's a couple of answers. First of all, it just made sense. And when I started writing, he wasn't necessarily that old. I don't think I really knew how old he was. So the book, I didn't have the entire book completely and utterly planned out and scripted almost before I began writing. So there's an element of him becoming that age organically, I guess.
That makes sense.
But also, and this is kind of something that I suspect writers don't talk about often, but there are certain pragmatics. And once you've written, say, 50, 60,000 words of prose, there are lots of things that need to add up, like dates and ages of characters and when certain events happened, when things happened in the backstory and all that kind of thing. And having done all that maths and kind of made sure that it all worked together and all the dates matched, all that kind of thing, it turned out he was around that age. And also, I guess my parents are older than that, but they're kind of early 60s now. But mid 60s now. I've been a bit too kind on them there. And I guess, you know, the novel's a lot about where I come from and that kind of thing. So it was kind of watching others rather than it being my own personal experience.
Gotcha. And how much of it then is real and experienced, and how much of it is imagined?
Most of it, so I would say 80, 90% of it is imagined. There are a couple of scenes in the novel which are kind of retellings of things that have happened to me, but those scenes aren't particularly major parts of the book. So there is a scene sort of early on of Gordon is waiting in the waiting room of the doctor's surgery, and the doctor leaves the intercom system on. So they use an intercom that plays out when they want a patient to come in next. They say, you know, Trevor Jones next, please, and Trevor Jones we'll go into the doctor's surgery and the doctor will turn off the intercom. That's fine. And when I was growing up, this happened and the doctor forgot to turn the intercom off. So we heard the first 30 or 40 seconds of this this kind of discussion, which is obviously meant to be personal. So there's kind of that scene was something that happened to me, and I adapted it and kind of tried to add an element of humour into it. But the crux of the novel, which is about, you know, Gordon Kingdon, the narrator, he's looking after his wife who's had a series of strokes and he doesn't know how to cope with it. And the novel is about the way he kind of unravels mentally as she unravels physically. And that's entirely fiction. That's not happened to me personally. I've not had anyone in my family who's had a stroke. So it was almost entirely imagined.
Oh, well, good news that hasn't happened in your family. Yeah. Long may it continue like that. So obviously this book must have taken the best part of 7 or 8 years to write. When you're in that writing process, when you're actually doing the job of writing, how do you get into that creative zone?
Well, this has changed over time. So, and I think I've been through a number of zones, and I feel like I'm about to enter a new zone. I don't know whether there's a name for it. But initially, I began writing the novel when I was part of Sheffield Hallam's MA writing course. So I was in an environment with lots of other writers, all of whom were at a similar sort of level and had real ambitions to be published authors. And when you're in that kind of community, that kind of writing environment, it's much easier to get into the zone, because you know that you have people asking for work, for example. You know that people are going to be reading what you write, and you know that, for example, you need to have something done by next week or next Tuesday because you have a seminar and you need to show your work. So getting into the zone isn't that hard, because there's a deadline, basically, and there is a community of people expecting it. Once that process was through, I did the first, on the MA you do around, I think it's 10,000 words, and then you're kind of left to your own devices for up to 5 years to get it finished and get to a master's level. And so that was all done on my own, and it was much more difficult to get into the zone. But what happened was I found myself naturally, and it felt like a very physical thing, and I know that you're the expert, so you can perhaps tell me whether I'm making this up or not, but it always felt like a very physical thing where I would perhaps struggle for the words like most writers, and then almost silently, almost without me really realizing it, half an hour would have passed and I would have found that at some point something had clicked and I was entirely focused on the writing and absolutely nothing else, no distractions, nothing could have interrupted me, and I was entirely focused. I was probably dribbling or something on my keyboard. I was just so into it.
The dribbling zone, that sounds like a new one that I might need to write about.
Indeed.
And so when did you have moments where you got blocked, and how would you deal with getting through the creative blocks?
I did have moments when I got blocked, and that was where I had to stop this kind of carefree attitude. I will just write and see how the story goes. There came a point, when it's something as long as a novel, there comes a point where you really do have to get some structure and you have to get some direction. So I tried kind of this, like I say, more of a kind of sit down and write and the story will come. And I got to a point when that it wasn't really happening anymore, because I was really fretting about what it was that I needed to do. I realized that this needed structure, and so I had to, I guess, perhaps find a different zone. I had to try and think less about the writing and more about the concept and the idea and the characters and how they would work together rather than the actual words on the page.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I love that you've got some great evocative chapter titles like First Strike and Oracle and Quarantine and Umbridge, a word I really like for some strange reason. But also I noticed, I couldn't help but notice, that the chapters were in alphabetical order. So where in the process of crafting the novel did this architecture appear?
Well, the architecture actually changed and changed significantly. So the reason the chapters are alphabetical, is because Gordon keeps notes. So he keeps notes and he keeps a series of files. This is how he copes with the situation. He writes everything down. So it was to mirror the structure of the novel kind of mirrored the structure of Gordon's kind of note-taking. So that was the A to Z idea.
Did that come first then? Or
it did.
Yeah,
it did. So initially I'd got the first draft. In fact, the draft that I submitted and got an agent with was 26 chapters, A to Z. And a lot of the titles, and I think probably all of the ones you just listed, didn't exist. But when my agent took me on, she said, "Are you open to doing a bit of work on the novel?" And I said, "Of course," because I was delighted to even be in that position. And the novel went from 26 chapters to 42. And that was quite a significant change of plan. And I actually suggested getting rid of the chapter titles completely. And it was because I felt like at that point, I felt like I had basically imposed this structure, this kind of way of doing things, this order that things had to be on myself in order to be creative. I felt like it was helping. And then it got to a point where actually I'd made the novel too short. I'd made some chapters a bit clunky simply because I was trying to fit into this certain structure, and it wasn't working. So I had to change it.
Well, it worked for me because I found that I read a B and I had to read a C and a D, and it had that sort of that Dan Brown effect where it's like a guilty pleasure, and you kept, I just wonder what happens next.
Well, that's good because it's, I mean, that's fantastic to hear, because with a literary novel, especially one where the subject matter is dark in places. I mean, I hope that there is some humour in there, but, you know, the subject matter is dark. So, and a few people have said this, that it was, I don't think I could perhaps call it a page turner in the Dan Brown sense, but certainly that people were wanting to know what was next. And that's quite difficult to do when you're not, you know, writing a thriller or, there are no guns, for example.
and talking of what's next for you, are you going to write a book with beef or something else?
No, but it is interesting how many people have asked if there are going to be a sequel. I mean, the ending is, I guess, a little vague and kind of open to interpretation. But still, people crave sequels these days, don't they? People want to hear more from the same characters, and a lot of people have asked that. But sadly, that's it for the world of Aes Frangelica. But I am working on a new novel at the moment. I do have some non-fiction as well, kind of 20-odd thousand words that are just sat there. I'm deciding whether I should do anything with them or not. But so I'm working on a new novel at the moment.
Oh, well, I hope it goes well for you, because yeah, that was a great debut novel. Really, really enjoyed it. And for me, it seemed to be from the pen of somebody that's written more than that and had much more life experience than you had. Well, certainly at 23, for certain. So where can people find out about you and your work and get your book?
You can find out about me on my website. That's ianbroome.com, and you spell my name in a slightly unusual way. It's ianbroome.com, and I have a blog on there. I have the podcast, which you mentioned, so lots of stuff for readers and writers, and you'll also find a page which is all about the novel too.
Wonderful. Well, it's A for awesome as far as I'm concerned. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you.
And we'll hear more from Ian a bit later. But my fourth guest today is somebody who's written a book about how you can find your niche in life. Hi, so I'm thrilled today to be speaking with Brian Cormac Carr about his new book, Vital Vocation. Now, I've just read the book and I'm just in awe. I think it's so comprehensive. It's more than just a workbook. It's a kind of clarion call for people to get off their butts and just do something where they love the work they can do. So where does it come from? How did you come about it?
Hi, Tom. Great to be with you today. I suppose, really, I've written the book that I wish I had a few years ago when I was in a job that I was unhappy in and looking for what I now call a vital vocation, but looking for my ideal work. And I tell the story in the book of being a retail manager, in a very good job, one that I did enjoy, actually, much of it. But I just never really felt I was in the right place for me. It didn't feel like the right job. It didn't feel like the right environment. It didn't feel like I was pursuing the values that really mattered to me. And so I started the process of looking for something else and went on a bit of a journey and did find something else and looked back on it and thought, you know, I would have liked to have had a guide really to help me along the way. I figured it out and did it all by instinct and accident, most of it. And I thought actually it would be useful to write this down and just share some of what I've learned, because what I've discovered is that everyone can find their vital vocation.
So what is a vital vocation then?
Well, the reason I call it vital vocation is it's based on the idea that we each have a calling inside us. And some people listening will probably think, I don't have a calling. That sounds far too dramatic. But what I've discovered is that actually we do all have a calling. We all have something that we deep down know that we are meant to do, or born to do, or designed to do, you might say, and it's possible to find that. The mistake that we sometimes make, I think, is that we assume that it's going to be something dramatic or glamorous, and sometimes it is, but sometimes it's really quite mundane, but there's nothing wrong with that. If that's what you're called to do, then that's the right vital vocation for you, and it's always based on your talents. So I think if we're doing a job or building a lifestyle around our talents and the things that we love to do the most, that's what's going to make us happiest. And so that's the starting point for me with helping somebody find their vital vocation. You know, what is it you love to do? And we'll build around that, and that will be the kernel that your vital vocation is built around.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, I did a little research before we started the call, and I was looking up the etymology of the word vital and vocation.
And vital, of course, comes from the Latin vita, meaning life, and vocation comes from the Latin vocatio, meaning a calling.
Yeah, that's right.
So how beautiful is that? It's a life calling.
Yeah, it energizes you. It makes you feel alive. And it's, you know, and it imbues you with a sense of vitality. You know, we all know what it's like to be in a job that drains energy away from us. And, you know, if you're in your vital vocation, you'll generally find that it energizes you and makes you feel better rather than worse, which is what we're all after, really, isn't it?
Do you get called? Or do you have to listen? Or do you have to find this thing? How do you go about getting your vital vocation?
Well, there's lots of different ways. Some people already know. They already know what they're called to do. They have a burning desire, a burning ambition. Sometimes they believe it's not possible to do what they feel that they should be doing. You know, they think, I don't have the talent, I don't have the ability, the obstacles are too great, I don't have time. You know, I can't leave my currently well-paid job in order to pursue this. So there's all kinds of obstacles that can be in the way. And if somebody's in that position, I work with them to remove those obstacles or deal with those obstacles. Mm-hmm. And there's always ways of doing that. Obstacles can either be internal or external in the real world, but there are always ways of dealing with them. Mm-hmm. Or you might be a person who doesn't know what you want to do, or you think that you haven't got a calling. And what I usually advise then is, at a very basic level, you start off by just noticing what you love. You know, something that really struck me is that if you think of anyone who is talented at something, you know, maybe it's somebody famous that you know of, or an artist or a musician who's very talented, you almost invariably find that they love what they do. You very rarely hear somebody say, you know, who's a talented singer, "Oh, I hate singing. I wish I didn't have to sing again." Mm-hmm. You know, you always find that they're very enthusiastic and they love what they do. And so I really have turned it the other way around and said, well, if, you know, if you're talented and you love what you do, finding what you love can help you find your talents. So I advise people to start off by looking for, you know, just being observant of the things that they love. And at a deeper level, there are some exercises they can do. And I describe those in the book, where they can look back to their past and think of some of the things that they thought about doing when they were younger. Some of the really big dreams that they had. Mm-hmm. They can explore their imagination. So what are some of the things they fantasize about doing? And that's a lot of fun, because, you know, if you start thinking about what you fantasize about doing, there's always something in there that's of use. So I'm not saying that if you sit at home, you know, as a couch potato and fantasize about being a professional footballer, that means you should be a professional footballer. Maybe it means that, but it might mean something else. What it might mean is that you enjoy some of the things that go with being a professional footballer. Maybe you like the idea of fame or money or being physically fit or achieving something, you know, in terms of developing your own skills. So the trick there is to identify what you're fantasizing about and then explore what is it about that thing that matters most to you. And once you've discovered that, it's like a kind of a touchstone, I suppose. You can start from that and build around it and look for other things that will fulfill that same need. People, don't ever dismiss your dreams, even if they feel really outlandish and even if they're not realistic. There's a message in there for you.
So when you're in a situation you're not happy with, many people just assume that's their lot in life and they just can't move forward.
Yeah.
So are you saying that everybody on planet Earth has a vital vocation?
Well, yes, I think I have to qualify that by saying that obviously many of us are fortunate enough to live in a part of the world where it's possible to explore lots of options. It's possible to, you know, tap into some of the resources that are available to us. And not everyone in the world is that lucky. So I'm not going to pretend that if you are somebody who lives in a very impoverished country or war-torn country, you can just suddenly drop everything and go exploring for your ideal work. Although, you know, there are people who've done that kind of thing. And you know, people who, particularly people who work in the kind of social enterprise field, who see a need around them and address that need in order to make the world a better place. So you don't have to start from a perfect starting point to do this. But yes, I believe that everyone has something inside them that they're designed to do. And I also believe that everyone can find it in some form. The mistake we make, I think, is that we sometimes think that our job has to do everything for us. It has to fulfill everything, or it's just not good enough. So if we're in a job that we're unhappy with, we sometimes think, well, that's my lot in life, and that's it. Where actually what I would explore with somebody is, if the job you're in, as long as it's not toxic, as long as it doesn't make you absolutely miserable, as long as the people you're working with aren't so horrible that every time you go home you have to drink a bottle of wine just to get through the night, you know, if it's not that bad and it's helping you earn a living, there's nothing wrong with keeping that job and then in your spare time exploring some of what you really love. You know, your vital vocation doesn't have to be one thing. I know lots of people, many of my clients have got to the stage where they have a job that puts, you know, food on the table, doesn't make them miserable, and leaves them with enough time to pursue their passions. And you can build a really happy life with that model. Alternatively, you might be somebody for whom your vital vocation is your job, and you want to find a job that really enthuses you and it becomes an important part of your life. And there's, I talk in the book about there being two paths to a vital vocation, and those are those two paths. You know, a good enough job plus your passions, or a job that is your passion.
Lovely. So when you're in your vital vocation, how do you know you got there?
Well, people sometimes ask me, if I'm in my vital vocation, will I, you know, be joyful and full of bliss the whole time? And, you know, my answer to that is no, you won't. You know, even in your vital vocation, there will be frustrating days. I think what makes it different to a job that you don't enjoy is that in your vital vocation, you don't mind the frustrating days and you can see the point of them. So, you know, you'll maybe be doing something that's frustrating and difficult and maybe even a bit boring, but because your overall job or lifestyle is satisfying to you, it feels right. You know, you don't feel bitter about it. You don't feel annoyed about having to do it. You just get on with it. And most of your working life and most of your job will be enjoyable. And you know that you're there when it feels right and you feel you're in the right place. There are four factors that make up a vital vocation. One is your talents, so using your talents. And you'll know if you're using things that you're naturally good at. It'll feel natural. You'll feel like you're in that flow where everything just happens, not necessarily easily, but in a way that feels right and effortless to you. Another factor is values. So you'll feel that the work you're doing is furthering the values that are important to you. So the needs that you see in the world are being addressed by what you do, or you're working in an area that matters a lot to you. The third factor I talk about is environment, and that can mean the place that you work in or the country that you work in or the working conditions, you know, the reward level that you get. You know, that will feel right to you. And then the last thing that I talk about, and this is sometimes the first thing that other career books talk about, the last thing I talk about is skills. So you'll be using a range of skills. Most jobs require you to use a range of skills, and a large proportion of those in your vital vocation will be skills that you enjoy using, but not all of them. You know, I think we've got to be realistic. You know, nobody has got a perfect job. We all have to do things that are frustrating to us. And I encourage my readers and my blog readers and my clients not to assume that everything will be perfect. I think sometimes in the self-help industry, we start pursuing perfection. And then if we think that what we're doing is not going to be perfect, we almost, you know, say, well, let's just give up. And that's a real shame, because we miss out on so much by doing that.
If you got, let's say, 3 or 4 people, or even 300 or 400 people that are all pursuing their vital vocation in a company, does this scale up? So does it scale up to the size of a business? Does it scale up to a nation state?
Well, it really could, couldn't it? If everyone in that company is playing to their strengths, then, you know, that could really be a formidable company. The company I work for, the charity that I manage, we have a range of people all doing different things, all with different skills. And one of the things that I think is a strength of the organization I work for, which is BVSC, is a charity that helps other charities to develop and fundraise and find volunteers and find staff and so on. One of the strengths of that organization is that people are guided to play to their strengths. And, you know, people aren't forced into doing things that they're not naturally good at. I always say, if you're not good at doing something, there's usually somebody else in the world that has been invented to do that thing. So let's get them to do it. You know, play to your own strengths and let other people play to theirs.
Yes. So Brian, obviously people can get the book, and it's available on Amazon for Kindle and in print.
That's right, yeah.
And you also work one-to-one with people, and I think you do workshops and that sort of thing as well.
I do, yes. And if they would like to check my website, it's cormaccarr.com or vitalvocation.com. That's my career coaching blog. They'll find information about the book and about my one-to-one coaching service.
Wonderful. Well, it's been great to speak to you today. Well done at getting the book out there. It's so needed. I needed it 30 years ago, but I'm glad I read it now. And I hope this is one of many conversations we have in the future, Brian.
I hope so too. Thanks very much, Tom. It's been great to speak with you today.
My pleasure.
So we'll have a bit of music next from Sam Joseph, who's going to be on the show in a few weeks' time, before we come back to Ian Broom to talk about how he approaches live performance and how that's different from writing. So welcome back to The Zone Show, Ian. And we've just been talking the last conversation about Aper Angelica, this book that took a good 8 years to write. So you've now written the book, you've published the book. How have you found segueing into the performance zone and then promoting the book?
Well, as many of my friends will perhaps tell you if you were to ask, I've always been kind of comfortable with kind of performing and showing off, hopefully in a relatively polite kind of way. But I've always been quite outgoing and confident externally Obviously, it's not always the case that that's how I feel inside. You feel nervous when you have to perform, and you know, you worry about, for example, going on stage to do an author event. So that's one of the things I've had to do. I've performed at a couple of literary festivals, spoken word events, interviews like this. You know, is a performance in a sense, and it's something that I was comfortable with doing anyway. So I previously hosted a spoken word night, so a live spoken word event that was a monthly thing, and I was the host and had to introduce people. And a lot of that was, there's a clear difference, I think, between the things I'm doing now, which is performing my work. So I read from A.S. Frangelica, and maybe talk a little bit about the book. To doing the hosting, which was more about ad-libbing and you know, saying something funny in between the acts, that kind of thing. So it's been mainly about performing live and reading my work since the book came out.
So authors tend to be solitary creatures who sit alone in their garret. In the old days, it was in front of a typewriter. Now it's a word processor or even an iPad or a tablet. And many of them, I've noticed, tend to be a little bit shy. So what tips have you got for people that may be a little bit reticent to put their head above the parapet and shout about their work?
Well, first of all, it will improve your work no end. If you do manage to find the confidence and from somewhere to go on stage in front of an audience, even if the audience is just a few people, even if it's your family at home in the living room or friends, by doing that, you really, by reading your work out, you see the flaws and you see the, you know, where the commas, perhaps there shouldn't be a comma or there needs to be a full stop somewhere. You really get to know your work a lot better when you perform it. I know some people do read it aloud to themselves, but when you perform it, that extra pressure really forces you into a kind of familiarity with your work that you hadn't previously got. But other than that, it's almost kind of required of authors these days. If they want their work to be read, you really need to put a lot of hard yards in yourself. You need to go on podcasts, go on radio. You need to perform your work at events, literary festivals, that kind of thing. You need to kind of try and find it, find that confidence from somewhere to do it. And of course, with these things, as with most things, it's all about practice. Once you've done it a few times, you get used to it, and the nerves are less and less each time, I think.
And what are your nerves like now before a performance?
Well, as I say, practice makes kind of, I don't know about perfect, but it certainly makes less nervous. So I'm much better at it now than I used to be. But I still get nervous. And the pattern tends to be fairly consistent, which is good. I tend to get quite nervous the day of an event, for example, and as the kickoff approaches, I get more and more nervous. And then something seems to happen to me, and it seems to be a physical thing where about, I don't know, 10 minutes to a quarter of an hour before I'm due to, you know, my slot is here. Something just happens, and I feel a calmness where I just go, and I have a similar feeling when I'm flying, actually. So when I'm not scared of flying, but I have a similar nervousness, then just as it happens, just as I'm sat on the plane, on the runway, it's the same kind of feeling. Just 10 minutes before I'm about to go on, something inside me says, well, you can't go back now. Therefore, stop being nervous, get on with it, it will be okay. And it's a very real thing. It's a real sort of physical thing that happens to me.
And what happens post-performance?
Well, I'm usually quite, especially if it's an important event, I think, and this may correlate with the nerves beforehand. So the more nervous I am, perhaps the more I'm like this afterwards, but it's a little bit hyper for the first sort of 10, 20 minutes, you know, really kind of riding on the crest of a performance wave, I suppose. And then at the end of the evening, kind of when the evening's finished, I tend to be much more tired than I usually am. But I suspect that's just the energy of the nerves and the act of, and the adrenaline and all that kind of thing wearing off. Like I say, I do think performance is a very physical thing. You do really feel it, I think.
And do you do anything in terms of preparing yourself, either eating or drinking something particular, whether it's either water or wine or beer or any particular foods?
Not really. I do tend to lose my appetite a little bit if I'm particularly nervous when I'm getting ready to perform. But that's partly because I'm trying to mentally prepare for what's about to happen. And I do ad lib quite a lot, so I'm quite comfortable with. That doesn't really make much sense, but I'm comfortable with not preparing because I feel like I am able to kind of make things up as I go along. But also this sounds silly, but there is some preparation that goes into ad-libbing almost. If you are aware that that's what you're probably going to have to end up doing, mentally you try and get yourself into a state where you're kind of able to think of things quickly and focus, I guess, really focus on what it is that you're about to do, and be sort of mentally ready. Don't be distracted by what you're going to have for tea or afterwards, or worry about what you're going to have to eat beforehand, I guess.
And is that focus directed at the audience and what you want to come from your performance and what you want the audience to gain from it?
I think it is, actually, and I've never really thought about it in that way, but I think I do think about what the audience is going to be like. And I think that's the tough thing when you don't know. So something like Words Aloud, which was the spoken word night I organised, the first night we had no idea who was going to turn up or if anyone would. And I was extremely nervous, and I guess because it was opening night. But once I knew the kind of crowd we were getting, and it was, you know, 100 to 150 people at a time, but I kind of knew who they were or what type of person they would be. And I think I was able to prepare for that a bit more and kind of think, right, I know that I might be able to say something along these lines at this point. But doing literary festivals recently, I've not really had a clue who's going to be there. And recently I did one in Coventry, and the room wasn't full, but everyone there was female, and I would say 50 plus. And I did sort of have to adjust slightly, and I don't know why. It's not to suggest that they would react any differently, but demographic does make a difference, I think. And you do have to kind of think, well, what would I probably not say, and what might work better with these particular people who are in this room.
So as this particular performance, this interview is not time based, so this is going to be on the internet ad infinitum. If people want to try and find you virtually in some sort of performance, where can they find you strutting your stuff?
Okay, well, I guess I do my own podcast, the Write for Your Life podcast. In a way, that's a performance. And if you, there are 80 something episodes now, so I guess if you had the time and kind of you really were bored, you could listen through and see how I changed and developed and performed better, I hope. But also there is some footage of me reading at Words Aloud on YouTube, and I think that's probably on my YouTube channel. And actually, yes, I do YouTube videos too, so there is an element of performance in those. In fact, it's all performance, but that's more kind of a talking head kind of thing. But there is stuff on my YouTube channel, so that's youtube.com/Ian Broom.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. Well, may you perform for many a day, Ian. It's again a delight to talk to you today, and look forward to having you back on the show very soon.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that very eclectic show with four different authors, all with slightly different approach, but all who've gone out there and written their book. And in typical Zone Show fashion, we'll just finish with some meditative music, again from Sam Joseph, who'll be on the show very soon. Thank you.